All right. You want? Do you want a mic?
Is that one?
There you go.
Hi guys. Just quickly making an announcement about the Student Tech Meetup. You'll have all received an email about it. It's being held next Wednesday at 6:45 in the Informatics Forum. We've got talks from Bloomberg, Thales, and Valley Technology. There's free pizza. If you're a ComSoc member, then it's free to get in. Otherwise, if you pay £2 to get in, we'll give you a free ComSoc membership for the rest of the year. So then there's another one next month with more free pizza. So you'll get more than £2 worth of pizza anyway, so it's worth doing. But yeah, it's all in your email, so see you there.
So I've had their pizza, it's pretty good. No, I'm not kidding, it's true. All right, ready? Hold on, you were quiet just a second ago. What's going on? All right, let's start. So, okay, today the lecture is going to be about first order logic. So, do you all know about first order logic? You've all heard about first order logic then? So, this is really a revision lecture then. Shall we just not do it?
Yes.
No, no. Go on, guys. It's all right. Okay, so this is from Russell and Norvig. Well, Russell and Norvig section 8.1 to 8.3 gives you a good coverage of some of the topics or some of the things we're going to look at. But you can find this in almost any book on first order logic, many of the things that we're going to cover today, right? So any self-respecting book on logic will have something. So since you've all heard about first order logic, this means we can really breeze through this fairly quickly. And hopefully it will sort of, you'll remember some of it if you haven't seen it since, I guess, last year. Okay. Right. So this is the outline of the lecture briefly. So one thing is, why do we need first order logic? We've got propositional logic. I mean, what's one good thing about propositional logic? One good thing that you need to know about. How's it? All right, you can use first order logic as well, though. One good thing is that you can, this is what your assignment is about, right? You can, it's actually decidable, right? So you have procedures that help you to decide whether something is true or not. Whether it's going to do it in any kind of respectable amount of time is a different issue, but in theory, you know, there isn't, you know, it's decidable. Any sentence in propositional logic is decidable. You can do it with truth table, for instance, right? So that's one thing, right? Anyway, we'll look at first order logic, but it's limited in terms of what it can represent propositional logic. So why fall and syntax and semantics of first order logic and a bit of this using it and the Wompus world. So really, if you've seen it all before, it's more of a revision. We need this because we're going to look at the resolution and we're going to look at some other stuff that we need. And also as a representation language, it enables you to express things more succinctly. But nothing comes free, right? So pros and cons of the propositional logic. So one other thing about propositional logic, which is good about it, is that it's declarative, right? So we saw this already. If you don't remember what this means, check the previous lecture. Or not the previous lecture, one of the early lectures, right? So propositional logic allows partial, disjunctive, negated information, which is what you expect, right? It's got all these facilities, you've got all these connectives, so you can represent these things, right? Unlike most data structures and databases. Although this is not, there are such things called deductive databases, so these are closer to, they're very logical in nature. But anyway, so very often you can't do negated information, for instance, right? And the other thing is that it's compositional, so you can get its meaning, or at least you can, from its components, right? So you can say the meaning of B11 and P12 is derived from that of the first conjunct and the second conjunct, for instance, right? So these are just kind of hopefully self-evident things. And meaning in propositional logic is context independent, right? So it doesn't matter on the context at all, right? Which is unlike natural language where the meaning does depend on the context. If I say it, it will, you know, refer to different things in different contexts, right? So it could be this lamp there, or it could be this table, depending on what I'm pointing at, right? But the big problem is that it has quite limited expressive power, unlike natural language, for instance, right? So for instance, you cannot say pits cause breezes in the adjacent squares. There's no way of saying this in a kind of generic way, sort of kind of general fashion. You need to write one sentence for each square. You remember this, right? So you would need to express, for each square, you would need to say that. So if your grid's got 4 squares, you need to say it for each of the squares. Got 16 squares, you need to say it for each square. So it really very quickly blows up the number of sentences that you have, which is not really practical, right? Well, in practice, makes that much more, you know, make your database or your database of facts really grow very quickly. And it seems redundant. So what we want to address is some of these issues using first order logic, where we can hopefully come up with ways of writing things more concisely through having extra syntax. Right? So what do we do? What does first order logic do? So whereas propositional logic is going to assume the world contains facts, right? So, you know, you have a proposition. It's P or not P. That's the atom, right? You can't delve any further into this, right? So first order logic assumes the world contains things such as this. So it's going to assume that you have some kind of domain, usually, of objects. So you're going to have a universe of objects about which you're going to talk about, such as people, houses, numbers, colors, football games, etc., etc., tables, mugs, chairs, whatever, right? So you're going to assume that there are objects about which you can talk, right? So that's one thing. So this is going to be, you're going to have it's known as the domain, right? And you also have what are known as relations, right? You can say something is red, you know, it's round, it's a natural number is a prime number, or you can talk about somebody being the brother of somebody else, so there's a relationship between objects, right? Bigger than, part of, comes, between, etc., whatever, right? And then, these are going to have truth value, true or false, right? And what happens is that propositional logic really, a proposition is really can be viewed as a relation which doesn't take any argument, which doesn't apply to any particular object per se. But we'll see this. So functions are the third things that you have. So this is things such as, you know, you give it an argument and it's going to return a value to you. That's one way of looking at it informally. So you can say the father of some person, for instance, or the best friend of some person you're talking about. Or you can say one more than, you can have addition, you can have subtraction. So these are different, right? So they're not going to be Boolean values, they're not going to be true or false. They're going to give you something else in return, right? So 1 plus 2, you know, plus is a function, right? Things like that. So this is how things start to differ. So we have objects, relations, and functions, okay? You're happy so far? You remember this, vaguely? So these are the basic elements slightly more formally. So you have notion of constants. So for instance, you could say number 2, the University of Edinburgh, or UOE, or King John, or whatever. You can have fixed objects. These are known as constants, right? And you can have predicates. So like I said, so for instance, you could write it as brother, or greater than, or whatever. If we want to write it slightly more formally, if you're going to write it in a particular language. And you can have functions, like I said before, square root function, right? Now, the left leg of somebody, for instance, it returns the left leg. And you're also going to have these things which are variables. So this is what we lack these things. These are going to range over the objects. So they're going to give us more power, right? So you can have X, Y, A, B, whatever. You can say these are variables, right? And we also have so these are the same things we had before in propositional logic, such as negation, implication, conjunction, disjunction, and if and only if, right? So these are the same. We have the same connectives. We also can assume, so in some presentations, sometimes equality is not taken as a primitive, but we can do that. It depends on the presentation. So we're going to assume that we also have equality in this case, right? And what also is going to be different are these quantifiers. Do you remember these? So this is called? Yeah, you do know. So really, we don't need this lecture, right? You remember everything. Yeah, so, which is good. So what can we talk about then? So we can talk about the notion of formula So we can say we have something called an atomic formula, which is just this. It's going to be a predicate applied to terms. So what does term mean? We're going to define terms slightly below. So a predicate is going to be something such as round or prime, and it's going to apply to a term of some kind, right? So something called a term, or more than one term, or n terms, for instance. Right? Or in this case, since we're taking equality as a primitive, we can say term 1 is equal to term 2. So we can have this is as a binary relation here. Right? And so what is a term? A term itself is just going to be a constant, right? Like number 2, number 3, or whatever. Or a variable, x, y, b, right? Or it can be a function applied to a number of terms, right? N terms, right? So very often in some presentations, we don't distinguish between, so a constant itself is viewed as a function which takes no argument, for instance. So in this case, we're separating this. We're saying a function is something that takes at least one term, right? But sometimes in some presentation, a constant itself is just viewed as a term which takes no argument. It's a nonary function, so it doesn't take any argument. But it's okay. So then if we say this, so we can look at this, we can say brother. Here, King John is the brother of Richard the Lionheart. So what have we got there? So brother itself is a predicate, right? And this is going to be, this is a constant, and this is another constant. So this is either true in some way of saying, you know, this is either true or false. So it's going to have a Boolean value, okay? Or we could write something like this. If somebody says, okay, the length of the left leg of Richard is greater. So basically, this is saying Richard has a longer left leg than King John, right? Than King John's left leg is longer, right? So we could write it like that, right? So here's the thing. So this is written there, the leg greater than as a predicate. Length is a function that takes left leg of someone, for instance, and returns to the length of the leg. Left leg itself is a function, so you can have a function as an argument to another function, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And these are constants there. So you'll notice very often we don't write it like this, right? We write the greater than like this. So this is known as a prefix form, where you write it at the beginning. But most of the time, the way we're used to it is that we write it as an infix. It lies between it's going to lie between the two terms, right? So instance, like in this class, so if we could have written equal term 1 comma term 2. So then you will see that equal is just a predicate, right? So, but most of the time, there is some what's known as syntactic sugar that makes it a bit more palatable when we're writing these things on paper. But if you had to implement this, right, your implementation might be of that form where this would be like this. But when you pretty print it, you pretty print it differently, right? So there is a difference between what you see and what it might be represented underneath, how it might be represented underneath. Any questions so far? So good? Okay. So. And then what we can do, we can build more complicated formula or more complex formula by just building these from atomic formula using the usual connectives, negation, conjunction, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So now what can we say? We can say, okay, the sibling, somebody is a sibling. King John is the sibling of Richard, implies that Richard is a sibling of King John. Right? So it's a symmetric relation in this case. So we can write something now. We can say, if this is true, then this is true, for instance. Right? Or we can write something like this, 1 is either greater than 2, or 1 is less than or equal to 2. Right? Of course, like I said before, usually we're used to this being between the two, right? So as an infix. Or we could say 1 is greater than 2, and not the case than 1 is greater than 2. Right? So we can write these things, and they're perfectly valid formula or complex formula in first order logic. So that's just syntax right now so far. Okay? Okay. So after syntax, so if you're all happy with this, that's the general idea, right? So we can look at what the meaning and the semantics of first order logic. So there's a formal way of giving semantics to first order logic. So how do you give semantics to propositional logic? A formula of propositional logic or a sentence of propositional logic? What does it mean? Can't remember? If I gave you P and Q. No? Proportional logic, right? Semantics is just an assignment of to the individual symbols, right? So you just say, how do you give it meaning? You just give assignments of truth value. That's what you do, right? So what do we do in this case? It's slightly more complicated. So formula are going to be mapped to what's known as an interpretation, right? So we're going to have an interpretation. So what is an interpretation? So, well, they are mapped to an interpretation, that's the thing. So an interpretation then is called a model of a set of formula when all the formula are true in the interpretation. So we have another notion of model here. Well, similar, it's all about, but we relate it to the idea of an interpretation. So an interpretation is called a model of a set of formula when all the formula are true in the interpretation. So what does that mean? What does it mean to say we have an interpretation? So what does the what is the interpretation? So it's going to contain objects, right, which are the domain elements. So remember, so it could be set of numbers, for instance, that's the domain, the objects we're talking about, or it could be number set of students for, you know, whatever the domain we're talking about. So these are known as the domain elements sometimes, right, and relations between them, right? So what does this interpretation do? It's going to specify mapping. What does it do? It's going to specify mappings, right? So it's going to say, it's going to map specific for the reference for, so it's going to say a constant symbol gets mapped to object, to an object in the domain, right? So I say something's a constant, I can map it to something. If I say P of A, I'm going to map P, which is the predicate to some relation, actual relation. So if I say P of AB, for instance, right? So I'm going to try and come up with a mapping and interpretation for this. If I'm talking about the set of people containing John, Mary and Bill, or whatever, right? So then the constant symbols, if I say P of AB, I'm going to try and map P to some relation that I know over these people. So maybe the relation is dislike, right? So P gets mapped to dislike, right? And A can be mapped to something, right? So you can map A to Mary, and you can map B to Bill. So then it, what it would say is that we have, well, which one? Mary dislikes Bill. Right? Whether this is true or false is a different issue, it depends, right? But that's the mapping, that's what you do. So you map the constant symbols from your actual statement that you have, your formula, P of AB, you map the constant symbol. If I tell you that A and B are constants, you map these to actual objects in the domain, and you map the predicate symbol to some kind, to some known relation that you have that about these objects. Likes, dislikes, hates, loves, whatever, right? Kills, whatever. So, and what do you do for the function symbols? You also, you map them to actual functions, right? So for instance, it could be like, no. So it could be about numbers, for instance. So I could give you something which is now P F of AB, right? So I could write something like this. I say P takes an argument F of A, and the other argument is B. So P could be mapped to greater than, right? For instance, so F of A is greater than F than B. Right? So f of a could be mapped to something else. So for instance, it could be mapped to a function. So you're going to map f to some function over numbers. Maybe it's the inverse function. So it becomes 1 over a is greater than b. Then you map a to something, and you map b to something. So a gets mapped to 3, and b gets mapped to, I don't know, 0. Right? Something like that. So then whether this is true or not, right, this depends on what you know about arithmetic, or about, yeah, about arithmetic in this case. Right? Does that make sense? So we'll see another example. So an atomic formula predicate like this, right, if we have this, is true if and only if the object objects referred by the terms, right, are in the relation referred by the predicate. So that's the example I just mentioned to you, right? If 1/3 is greater than 0, then it is a true. It's the atomic formula is actually true, right? So if we look at something, you know, slightly more, you know, graphical, so maybe our domain contains 5 objects, right? So we have something like 2 people in there, we have a crown, we have like left the legs. So these are the objects, right? Okay, so what do we do? So, and maybe we have like, so the unary relay, so we have these 2 binary relations, which are like brother, right? Is A, is something a brother of something else? Is someone a brother of somebody else? So, and crown on head. So these are the 2 relations there, right? And we have 3 unary relations, which are like, is somebody a person? Is somebody a king, or is something a crown, right? So, and then you have 1 unary function which just takes an object and returns, so in this case takes a person and returns the left leg, right? So these are just one way of looking at this. So I have 5 objects and I come up with all these various things and I give an interpretation where I'm talking about an actual person. So when is this true? If I say, okay, this is Richard and this is John, right? And historical, 2 historical figures, and we say, okay, is Richard the brother of John? And we map the notion of brother as a symbol that we have here to what we know about being a brother in real life, or, you know, in the real world. Is that true or false? So then you come up with a true value for this, right? And things about whether they have, they both had left legs. Well, so in this case, it's easy. Was John a king, right, as well? So that's a unary relation. So we map it about what we know about history. Right, assuming that we're mapping this John there to King John, right, and matching, and we're mapping Richard to historical Richard the Lionheart, right? Do you see what I mean? No. So otherwise, right, if I tell you this and I just give you Richard and John and you don't know anything about history, right? So these are just, you know, I could be, it could be I'm saying Richard here and John here, but it's referring to some other Richard and some other John, then it may not be true, right? So it depends on who, what the interpretation is, the meaning that you give to it in the real world. Well, yep.
Is there a way of defining commutative relation so that you wouldn't have to have two of
them? Commutative relation?
Yeah,
so you're going to specify this. Usually it's going to be some kind of statement about the relation itself. We'll see this in a second, actually. So, yes, there is. You need to give a property for it. You need to say if, well, we'll see for an example. So before we go there, we need to now go beyond, you know, we need to talk about these quantifiers that we had, right? So the general idea is that you're going to have universal quantification as one thing. So it says, you know, usually it's like the for all variable and some formula, but often written for all x, comma y. Sometimes the comma itself is omitted, is written for all x, for all y, p. So that would be, in this case, you know, if you map this, this is it, this is a formula. So the formula itself can be a quantified formula there, right? So here's something we could say. Once we have this, we could say something like this. Everyone at the University of Edinburgh is smart. Is something like this. Take anybody, right, for anyone, any x. If x is at the University of Edinburgh, then x is smart. Of course, you know, I can write this like this, right, but I can give semantics to this. This doesn't mean it's necessarily true, right? How do I give semantics to this? I need to go, well, there's the problem, right? How do I give semantics to this? So the idea for this is to give semantics for this is that for all x, p is true, right? I could have put a px there. In an interpretation m, if p is true with x being each possible object in the interpretation, so how would I show that this is true? If I assume that u of e is a constant that gets mapped to the University of Edinburgh. Basically, I would need to take each and every one of you here and across the University of Edinburgh and have some way of saying whether you guys are, each one is smart, right? So do you think this is a true statement, actually? Come on. Yeah, you should say yes, right? Right, so can you tell me why, you know, this is all very nice, right? But what is the problem you can foresee already with it? Can you foresee a problem with this? So this is saying, for all x, p is true in the interpretation, if p is true with x being each possible object in the interpretation, the problem is, what if your domain is infinite, right? What do you do? You're talking about a set of the, you know, you're talking about the set of natural numbers and you're trying to prove something about all possible natural numbers. So when do you stop if you're going to enumerate each one by one? So you can see already that a kind of model theoretic way of trying to show that all sentences are always true in all possible situations, that's going to be a problem, because if you have an infinite domain, it's a non-terminating process, right? So this idea of model checking is very tough in that case if you have an infinite domain, right? So anyway, so if we write this like this, so if, you know, depending on our domain, roughly speaking, is equivalent to the conjunction of instantiations of P, right? So really is what we're going to do. We're just going to try and enumerate all possible objects in the domain. So, you know, for some, we could say at King John at UOE and Smart King John, etc. But you can see you can almost have something which is perfectly valid. You can actually write this. It's perfectly fine, right? But it's nonsensical really in real life. If you map it to the real world, it's not possible. But there's nothing that says you can't actually say that, right? Whether you can prove it is a different issue. Right? Would you be able to do this? Well, yes. So it looks odd, but it's perfectly valid sentence in first order logic as far as we're concerned here. Right? Because if our domain contains the University of Edinburgh and people and chairs and tables, so basically you could say these chairs at the University of Edinburgh, that chair must be smart. Yep. So yeah. Yes. Anyway, so you can actually do that too. So let's keep any question about this? No? Okay, so one thing to avoid, right, just a common mistake, is that typically not, it doesn't mean it's like an, you know, it's an absolute rule, but typically implication is the main connective that goes with for all. So one common mistake people make when they're trying to say, okay, write this sentence, they're given something in English and say, you know, translate this into first order logic, they make the mistake of using N as the main connective with for all, which makes it look, which is not the right meaning. So for instance, if I say this, for all x at x University of Edinburgh n smart x, right? So everybody at the University of, anyone who's at the University of Edinburgh is smart. This is not how you would actually write it down, because what this is saying is everyone is at the University of Edinburgh and everyone is smart. So in English language, that's the problem, right? It's ambiguous. So one of the things we try to address by going to propositional logic or first order logic or a formal logical language is to try to address the potential ambiguity. So if I say, you know, anybody, everyone who goes at the University of Edinburgh is smart, I actually mean take anyone. If that someone goes at the University of Edinburgh, then that person is smart, right? If you write it like this and you think that's what it's saying, then no, you're saying everyone is at the University of Edinburgh and everyone is smart. And we know this is not the case. It's not what you mean, right? Okay, so just bear this in mind whenever your temptation is there to write an N when you have a for all. Just double check. Just see whether it does make sense. So what's the other one? So the other quantifier is the existential one. So it's usually written like this. We often write this for this. Very similar to what we have for all. And here's something else. So someone at the University of Edinburgh is smart. How would you represent this? It says, okay, there exists an X. That X is at the University of Edinburgh, and X is smart. So you'll see that there's an N in this case, right? So this is the general thing. So there is someone, and someone at the University of Edinburgh is smart. So there exists an X, P is true, is an interpretation, M, if and only if P is true, with X being some possible object in the model, right? So what's the problem with this one, too? It's another problem. It's similar, right? If the domain is infinite, you keep going. Maybe, you know, you hope there is someone who's smart at the University of Edinburgh. At least the domain is finite here. You will be able to finish that process eventually. But if you're taking an infinite domain, the fact that you haven't found someone who's smart in the whole universe, you know, let's assume you're taking the universe, the fact that you haven't found someone who's smart on Earth doesn't mean there isn't someone smart out there, right? We all know they're out there. So anyway. No, we don't? Yeah. So that's the thing. So that's another problem, right? Just think of it like this. You have a huge universe. Nobody's smart on Earth. You have to keep going until you find. But maybe you will never find anybody who's smart. But then you can't tell whether the sentence is actually true or not, right? So roughly speaking, this one is equivalent to the disjunction of instantiations of P, like this. So you just go for all the objects of the domain again, and you can just keep going. And again, you end up with something which doesn't seem to quite make sense, but which is perfectly fine. You can actually write this. Okay? Question? Still nothing? All right. Well, so another common mistake to avoid, so it's like a bit of a dual kind of thing. So typically, N is the main connective with existential quantifier, the existential quantifier. So the common mistake is to use this implication as the main connective, right? So if I wrote it like this, there exists an X. If X is at the University of Edinburgh, then X is smart. This is true if there is anyone who's not at the University of Edinburgh, right? Because anything false implies anything, the whole sentence is true. So that's not what you actually mean in that case. So if you say there is someone who is at the University of Edinburgh who's smart, you want to say there exists an X. That X is at the University of Edinburgh. I want to show that this is true first. Now I want to show that X, once I've found him or she or whatever, I've found he or she, that he or she is smart. It's more likely to be a she, I think. So anyway. Right. What about the properties of these quantifiers now that we've got them, right? So, well, one thing we can say is that for all X, for all Y, that's the same as for all Y, for all X. So you can change the order of the quantifiers. So that's not a problem, right? And it's the same for both of them. So the ordering doesn't matter if they're the same, right? If the quantifiers are all the same. But it's definitely not the case that you can change the order if you have the existing X for all Y. You can't change it to for all Y, the existing X, right? Because they don't mean the same thing, definitely. And you can look at a particular example here. If I say the existing X such that for all Y, X loves Y, basically what I'm saying is there is a person who loves everybody, right? The existing X who loves everyone. Non-discriminating person loves everybody. But this one is, oh, maybe that's God, right? It's you. Who is it? Who is that who loves everybody? So, who? You love everybody. You sure? But, yeah. Wow. Wow. And I count as well, right? Yeah, that's the hard bit to believe. And how about this one then? But if I say for all y there exists an x such that x loves y, What does this mean? It means something else. It means everyone is loved by at least one person, right? It's saying for all y, there exists an x, x loves y. Yeah, everyone is loved by at least one person. I had to think about this again. So it's quite different. So this one means someone loves everyone, and this one means everybody is loved by at least someone, probably themselves, you know. But, you know, it could be, that's it, by at least someone, you know. So, well, imagine if someone is not loved by anyone, but they don't love themselves either. Yeah, so is this always true? I can't tell. So everyone is loved by at least one person. Let's go for the more positive spin on this, right?
But I still love by the person that loves
everyone. Oh, absolutely, because that person is all love. Yeah, it's a flower power kind of person kind of thing. Yeah. Ooh. But you're assuming this is true, right? How do we know whether you love everybody? We can't just take your word, you know. We need an empirical way of doing this. So we need to check everyone on Earth. Yeah. Anyway, let's not even go there. So remember this. So we cannot just change these quantities. So these are known as alternating quantifiers, and we can't just change these, right? And so these quantifiers. So then there's this other thing about the properties of quantifier. Basically, really, you don't need to have two quantifiers. Only one is enough because you can express one in terms of the other. So, for instance, if you say for all x, everybody likes ice cream. What does this mean in terms of a, you know, if you had to define it like this, you could say it is not the case that there's someone who doesn't like ice cream, right? So for all x can be expressed in terms of existential with negation. And it's the same for this one, so this is the dual of this, because you can say there is someone who likes broccoli, so it's not the case that anybody that you pick will dislike it, there will be someone. So it's a bit difficult. It's not the case that take anyone that you can find, keep going, it's the case that they will all not like broccoli. God.
No one.
Eh?
Is it not no one?
Yeah, it's not, but what do you mean? Which one?
No one.
Oh, yeah, you can, but no one, yeah, right. You can, not no one, yeah, that's why it is. Yeah, but, you know, but no one is not a quantifier we've introduced, right? You're already using an abbreviation, but it is not no one. Any questions? No? All right. So what about equality, given we made it a primitive in our thing? So term 1 is equal to term 2 is true under a given interpretation, if and only if term 1 and term 2 refer to the same object. Seems trivial, but that's the definition, right? So if you're asked, you need to give this, which sounds trivial, right? So what we can do using equality, then we can use this to define the notion of a sibling or in terms of parent, for instance, right? We can say, take any x, take any y, x is the sibling of y if and only if x is not the same as y. So we want to show that there are two different objects who are, you know, two different people who are siblings, for instance. And it's not the case that they have, you know, that, and then you have an f, you have an m, so you have two objects there which are not the same, right? Because that's the bit there. So you have f, m, and f, they're not the same, and it happens to be that m is the parent of x, f is the parent of x, and m is the parent of y, and f is the parent of y, right? That's just one way of expressing the notion of being siblings, right? Without saying whether it's brother or sisters. So you have two objects which are not the same, who have two parents, who have the same parents. Well, yeah, so by parents we mean they have a mother and a father, basically, in this case, when we're doing the mapping, if we want to give meaning to this, right, that are not the same. Okay? So equality enables us to write something like this by telling us that there are more than, we need two more than more. So to be able to define the notion of sibling, what does this mean about the domain? What does this say about the domain? So the domain has to have at least two objects in there, right? Otherwise, you can't define the notion of sibling. Right? Probably more. Yes. Ooh, yeah. So that doesn't rule out why being a brother or a sister and at the same time being the parent. Yeah, I don't think it does. You don't want to go there anyway. So, right. It doesn't. Ooh. Yes, a bit not too nice, this one. So anyway, so using first order logic, we can also express the kinship domain that we have. So we can say brothers or siblings, any 2x, y variable. So as you can see, now we can say any 2x and y. If x is the brother of y, then x, y are siblings, right? And we can say that one mother is one's female parent by writing it something like that, right? So for all m, for all c, if the mother of c is m, so you'll see there's something slightly different here. So we've not used mother as a predicate, but as a function, right? And then we say, and we've equality as the predicate. So we're going to say the mother of c is some m, then it is the case that if and only if m is female and m is the parent of c, right? So we could have written this differently. So it's a matter of choice. We could have said mother c m. So we could have had a relation instead, right? And here's one way of expressing symmetry. Somebody was asking about this. So usually you would express this, you would have a property like this that would be asserted about a particular predicate. To say that sibling is a symmetric relation, you would have for all x, for all y, sibling x, y, if and only if sibling y, x. So usually this can be taken, if you're trying to express something as in terms of as axioms, you're going to add, you know, these axioms about particular predicates and say, okay, this is something which is symmetric, right? You have other properties such as reflexivity and transitivity as well, if you know about this. So you can state this by saying, you know, whenever we have this, this is also the case. So that's an extra property that we have here. But that's one way of expressing it, using first the logic. Okay, so we can keep going. So this one is pretty, you know, that's just a tiny thing. But we could go and do something slightly more serious, for instance, the notion of set theory, right? First order set theory. So, I mean, I don't expect you to, you know, to memorize all these, but that's just to give an example, right? So, you know, this one is saying, like, for instance, if we use this as meaning that insert an element in a set, it is not the case that if you insert an element, so these are would be the properties of set theory that you want to hold for sets, right? So you can express what it means to be well-defined to be a set. So for instance, there is such a thing, there would be an axiom that would say it's not the case that there exists an X and S such that if I insert X in S, that it's equal to the empty set. So inserting an element in any set makes it non-empty, right? Like this one. So there's something that this one would characterize what it means to be a set, really. So to be able to say whether something is a set, it says for all S is a set, if and only if S is either empty, or it is the case that there exists an X and exists an S2, such that S2 is itself a set, and S is obtained by introducing some element X in S2, right? Or inserting it in there. So that characterizes, this gives a predicate for something being a set. And then there are also some other properties. So for instance, here's the subset relation. It says for all S1, S2, S1 is a subset of S2. If and only for any element that I pick, if this element is a member of S1, it's also a member of S2. Does that make sense? It should be like the usual notion that you should know about this, right? And two sets are equal if one is a subset of the other, one is a subset of one, and the other is also a subset of the first one, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And this is about set intersection, right, et cetera. So these are, you know, what you would do. So if I asked you to sort of reason about sets in a first order logic, in a first order language, or in first order logic, you could try to characterize the notion of being a set, like with these axioms, right? So what does it mean to be a set? This defines what a set is as a predicate, and these are the properties of the various operations that you can have of set or relations, such as set intersection as an operation, or you can have set equality or set subsets relation, right? Okay, so first order logic is very expressive. You don't need to talk about each individual set that you know about. It gives you a very abstract way of talking about the notion of sets, which you can then apply about to individual set of objects that you actually encounter, right? Any question? You all bored? You do look bored, actually. It's Friday. Yeah. So let's carry on, even though you're bored. So how do we interact with a first order logic kind of KB, right? So suppose we have our one plus world, and the agent is using a first order logic KB and perceives a smell and a breeze, but no glitter at time t equal 5, at some time t, at some variable t equal 5, right? So what we can do, remember we have this notion of, you know, this declarative way of doing this, where we tell something and then later on we can ask, right? So what we can say, we can tell the KB that there is a percept, so we'll assume it's limited to three percepts, right? So there's a smell, there's a breeze, and no glitter at t equal 5. So we're just saying we're going to tell that to the database. Now what we can do is ask a question. We can say, okay, use our quantifier, give me the best action. Is there some best action that I can do at A? There exists a best action, ask what this best action is, right? So the first of the logic gives you a nice way of saying, okay, is there some best action that I can do at five? Given this, I don't know what this A is. You know, tell me something that's going to be the best action there, right? So really what you're asking, does the KB entail some best action at T equal 5? So you have a nice way and a formal way of actually asking this to the database, right? So the answer that it might return, I'm not telling you how it does it right now, right, is that yes, A should be shooting, right, should be shoot. So this is known as a substitution. And usually you call this a binding. So the variable that you had, the quantifier variable that you have here gets bound. So it gives you a binding for this A that you didn't know. You just wanted an answer there, right? Follow this? So there exists some A. Tell me what this A is. Or is there some A, basically? And tell me what it is. So that's what it might return, right? So we're going to use this kind of thing because we're going to go into unification afterwards in the next lecture. I think it's the next lecture. So here's something you need to know. Given a sentence S and a substitution sigma, S sigma denotes the result of plugging sigma into S. So basically, it's the idea of substitution, right? If I have a formula like this, a sentence like this that says smarter XY, and sigma is X is Obama and Y is Palin, so I can then say S sigma means this. It's really trivial in a way, right? That Obama is smarter than Palin. Right? Is that true? Ooh, let's not go into politics either. We went into religion because he loves everybody. He's obviously God. But we need to stop here. So, but the thing to remember to look at is this, right? So it looks really trivial, but we need this idea of substitution. It's actually quite a formal concept, and we're going to see this, right? And we're going to look at this in more detail when we look at unification. So coming up with a substitution list is actually something which is very systematic that can be done algorithmically. And it's quite, there is an algorithm for doing this in first order logic when you're trying to find these kind of substitutions. And it gets much harder, it's not even decidable when you're talking about higher order logic, for instance. Anyway, so what we're saying in this case is we say ask the KB something, some S, is we're going to return some or all the sigma, so all the possible substitution, such that the KB entails this S with a substitution applied to it, right? Okay, so what we have in this case basically is that the first order logic gives us a way of querying, of telling things to our knowledge base using first order logic itself, and then of querying it using the fact that we have a richer language so that you can have existential quantifiers and all this, and you have a notion of substitution that comes with it. Okay. So what else can we do? So what do we have in our knowledge base in this case? So we don't need anymore to have like a sentence for each square and all these kind of things. So we can write things more nicely. So we can have the notion of a percept, for instance, right? You can say perception is like this. For all t, for any t, any s, any b, if, you know, the percept, there's a smell, there's a breeze, and there's glitter at t, this means you can actually say this, right? So if this is the actual percept at time t, right, s, b, and glitter is a constant, you can actually come up with a way of saying, okay, there was glitter at this particular time step, right? So notice this is different. This one is a constant, this one is a predicate there. There's no problem in having them for both, as long as you can tell the difference between the two. This one takes an argument, this one is just a constant. Right, so that enables you to write a perception. So it enables you to write a general sentence that captures the idea of their detecting or percept of a percept of glitter at a particular time t. Right, so if this gets satisfied at a particular point, so you're able to instantiate this and say this is true, then this can be added to the database or the knowledge base. Right, and what can I say? How do I capture the notion of a reflex action? For instance, I could have this one for all t at any particular time. If there is glitter, then the best action at this point is to grab t, right? It's to grab, not to grab t. The best action at this point is to grab, is to grab the goal because it's there, right? So that gives you a way of capturing the idea of, you know, immediately doing something at a particular time step, okay? What else can we do? Well, we can keep going, and we can actually now have the notion of adjacent squares, right? So in that way, so what we could do is that we have our grid, so we can write this like this now, and it's perfectly fine to write it like this using first-order logic, right? So we define the notion of squares using the grid, right, using the coordinates 1, 1, 2, 1, etc., etc. So what does it mean for two squares to be adjacent, a square xy to be adjacent to a square ab? For any x, any y, any a, any b, it just means you need to satisfy this particular set membership relation, right? So it has to be that ab is going to be this, is going to be a member of this set, right? Remember, these are all variables there. So you have a little bit of arithmetic as well going on there. Okay? And you can say something like this as well. If the agent is in a square, at a particular square, so in this case, at a time t, and there's a breeze at that time that's perceived, then this means this square is breezy. So you can actually write this down as well. And you can now, interestingly, you can define what are known as diagnostic rules and causal rules, so which is quite interesting, right? So the squares are breezy near a pit, so you can infer a cause from effect, from an effect, right? If it's breezy, right, then there exists a square which is going to be adjacent to S if a square is breezy, such that there's a pit in R, right? So that's basically enables you to make a diagnostic. And this one is a causal rule, so from the effect, you can infer the effect from the cause for this one. If there is a pit, this means that take any square that's adjacent to it, it's going to be breezy, right? Do you see the difference between these two, right? And that's quite interesting because depending on what you have, you can build different systems. What can be a diagnostic system, right? So diagnostic is often very useful for what kind of systems? Medical, right? For instance, yeah. So which one does Sherlock Holmes use?
Eh?
Does what is what? Sorry? Sherlock Holmes, what kind of, which one would be more useful for Sherlock Holmes?
Sherlock Holmes.
Sherlock Holmes. Holmes? You're mocking my accent now. You really don't love me. And then you claim to love everybody. Yeah. Newcastle. That. Anybody from Newcastle? Okay, let's not go there either. So, right, so what would Sherlock like? Which one would be better for him? No? Which one does he use more often? Come on. You guys spend too much time. You don't know who Sherlock Holmes is, right? You don't. God, who can I pick instead? Max Payne? No, he's a bit of a thug, so no. All right. So here's a summary. So first is the logic. We have objects and relations, which are semantic primitives, right? And we have the notion of the syntax. So the syntax is, you have more objects, you have more concepts in the syntax. So we have functions, predicates, in this case, quantifiers. You can also introduce equality as a primitive. And you have constants, right? So we have an increased expressive power, which is sufficient to define the one plus world. It was sufficient. You can define the one plus world using propositional logic as well, but you can't define it as nicely. So what happens in this case, you can define it much more concisely. Any questions? No. Have you started on your assignment? No. Anyway, how is the assignment going? You should start, so the lecture on Tuesday is going to be about the assignment. I've said this already several times, so please turn up because it could be helpful. You can ask questions. But no questions such as, how do I actually, what's the answer for this, right? Like, can I have the ASCII code for that? So these kind of things you can't do, right? But you should, if you read the sheet and actually think a bit about it, there you could ask some useful questions. And the other thing is, right, there will be, like I said already, there will be also a Haskell lecture, which is a complimentary lecture, right, to just help some of you who are still having problems with Haskell by the 13th, well into the assignment. All right, so, and the assignment lecture is going to be given by the TA, Petros, so you get to know who he is if you've not seen him already. And I've asked him to shave for the day, so, which will be nice. Anyway, thanks very much. I'll see you on Tuesday.